Okay, so for those who don't know me yet, I'm Gautam Menon. I work at the Institute of Mathematical Sciences, which is a kind of mid-sized institute in India. I work here. This is the city I belong to, Chennai, which is about 10 degrees north of the equator. It's usually warm and very humid most of the time. It does have the second largest urban beach in the world. So that's one reason why you might, one additional reason why you might consider coming there. So this is work with two people, a mature graduate student, who's sort of a college professor who decided to do a PhD, and an old, long-time collaborator called Shurjit Sen Gupta. So what I'll talk about is ideas about how you can think about active matter in a different context than have been discussed so far. So what you can call the active matter paradigm for biological systems says that, look, biological systems that are living can generically be thought of, of as matter out of thermal equilibrium. It's driven internally and not externally. The driving is typically GTP or ATP consuming processes, the hydrolysis of these molecules. And the non-equilibrium part is set by biochemical reactions that set the relative ratio of ATP to the product ADP. Here are two examples, one a neutrophil migrating, and this is just a cartoon of a motor moving, stepping forward, this kind of thing. There are some specific consequences that have been discussed so far about active matter approaches in a very general way. First of all, there are large fluctuations. There's increased sensitivity in general. There's a lot of collective behavior. You can have essentially molecules as small as this, scale of about 10 nanometers, combining forces in a way to give you structure and behavior and interesting collective aspects at scales of microns or tens of microns. So this coupling across very different length and time scales, and there's a nice, this inverse cascade description is sort of a nice way of putting it, and spatial structuring, which we'll come to a little later. So there are lots of models. So the earlier models, these in vitro models, are models for motor microtubule pattern formation by Nedlick and company, an experiment, very nice experiment, dating now about 15, 20 years ago. And then there's a lot of work on active membranes, which you don't see very much nowadays. So this relates to Jacques Rowe, Robin Bernstein, and other people. And in a sense, many of the ideas that are now used in active matter, the dipole idea, actually came from, were implemented first here in a non-equilibrium context. And then there's the whole field of self-propelled objects, a la Wiechek. So then, if you can look at sort of more biological systems and the idea of active self-organization, so here are these examples, and two of these people are in the audience. So there's actomyosin gel, self-substrate interaction, nanocluster domains on membrane, which is this idea that you can have what were earlier referred to as rafts on membranes, could really be a consequence of a lot of structuring just beneath the membrane, the actin cortex, forming little after-like structures which move molecules into zones where they can be further treated and defined over here. So one interesting thing about these examples, so these are canonical examples that we have heard about. We've heard about certainly the first two and less about the third, is that in a sense, in a deep sense, the physics underlying them is the physics of actin and myosin. So in a sense, if you sort of claim that active matter is an overarching theory or a way of thinking in physical terms about biological systems, it's kind of strange that we keep coming back to actin and myosin again. It's not that this is the only example, but it would be nice to find additional examples where these broad general principles that we think about might be shown to work or might be shown to be useful in the first place. So what I want to talk about is one particular other tractable in vivo active matter system, that's chromatin in the interface cell nucleus. I use tractable in a very specific way. I don't mean these are easy, they're very difficult systems. In fact, probably an order or two more complexity in magnitude than these. But tractable in the sense that a particular type of large-scale organization may be amenable to study mathematically and through theoretical modeling. So what I mean will be clear as I go along. So I want to talk about stuff that happens inside here. This is the nucleus inside eukaryotic cells. It's typically the largest membrane-bound organelle. There's DNA inside. There's a nuclear envelope with all sorts of interesting proteins attached to it that help to contain the DNA inside and modulates its behavior in interesting ways. This is sort of an old picture. Here is a sort of slice of cells. This is from the epithelium of a salamander. You can see these are particularly large nuclei, and you can see lots of very interesting different types of behavior. Here, these structures here are chromosomes that are just about being segregated to opposite ends of the cell.
Sorry?
And this is an earlier, yeah.
That's actually an image and not an illustration.
This is, I think, an image and not an illustration.
From 1900?
I don't know, actually. That's surprising. Yeah. Maybe it's drawn. So this is sort of the stage before this. And lots of this is really not very much happening. There's some amount of structuring here. But certainly not the sort of structure that you see here and here. Okay? So those different pictures are examples that are captured along different stages of the cell cycle. So the cell spends much of its time in between divisions. In stage it's called interphase, where the chromatin basically jumbles up with a structure like this. And then when it decides to divide, it goes through a sequence of changes here between the prophase, metaphase, anaphase, and telophase, and then goes back here. And then it can stay in this stage indefinitely if it wants to, or keep going around, in which case it's referred to as a cycling cell. If you take a cell whose total time between divisions is 24 hours, it spends about 22 to 23 hours in this intermediate interphase cell, so which is why this is, since it occupies so much of the time in between, this is the particular state that we've studied. The other states are much harder and more complicated to study, and we haven't got there yet. So just some terminology that I'll be using. DNA is an extremely packaged molecule inside the nucleus. It's packaged by histone proteins that are these structures here. The DNA complex together with these proteins is called chromatin. They come in two varieties, roughly speaking. So I just need you to remember the word chromatin here, histones here. And the structural entity, which is the bunch of histones and the DNA attached to it, is the nucleosome. So these are sort of nucleosome structures here. This beads on a chain, which then is further organized to forming these complicated chromosomal sex structures. So there are many levels of organization in between here and here. But one important intermediate state of organization is this package of histones forming the nucleosome that is moved around, removed, opened up, slid, etc., etc., etc. So, I don't know how to switch this thing off. Anybody know how to switch this thing off? Okay, now it's come off. Yes. So for many years, the nature of chromatin in between divisions in this interphase state was believed to show no obvious pattern of organization. So here's a nice quote from a nice review article by Kremer and Kremer. It says that during the 70s and 80s, most researchers seemed content with the assumption that the nucleus is filled with intermingling chromatin fibers and loops like a dish of spaghetti. And this is an assumption that was shared by many textbooks of biology from that period. But a very profound change in paradigm came with the ability to label each chromosome independently. And this is an amazing feat of biochemistry. So to fluorescently label each chromosome on its own, so these are different chromosomes labeled by different colors, and that's the actual image over there. This is the coding between the image and the actual. Oops. Showed several interesting things. First of all, this idea that chromatin is extremely entangled and mixed up structure is not true. Chromosomes tend to order in a very territorial manner. They tend to occupy their own distinct regions within the nucleus. And these distributions are random. This is another surprising thing that came out specifically with the ability to ask where is a chromosome within a given nucleus. So then you can ask the question, what governs this particular large-scale arrangement? What are the rules that govern this? What are the rules that make it meaningful? So the question is, given that chromosomes occupy non-random positions within the nucleus, what are the rules that govern them? Yeah? That's essentially this question. Are they really random? Are the rules that govern where they're placed?
And when you say random, you refer to what kind of ensemble?
Okay, so essentially what I mean is the experiment consists of taking a bunch of nuclei, so these are nuclei, looking at the positions of chromosomes in each of those nuclei, making a probability, so you make an image like this, so this is a sort of three-dimensional image of where these guys are, and then you make a distribution function. So this is the frequency at which you observe a nucleus at a chromosome at a particular distance from the center of the nucleus. Okay? So the experiment done on 30, 50, 100 nuclei gives you a distribution function of this sort. To the extent that the distribution function for chromosomes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10, etc. are different from each other, that suggests that the distribution is not completely uniform. And there is some sort of planning or some structuring that goes into deciding where chromosomes are positioned. Sorry. Yeah. So the earliest experiment that tried to quantify this in some way said the following. So this is by Croft Bridger and Wendy Bickmore's group. So what they said was, let's look at two specific chromosomes. They look at a whole bunch of them, but these are the ones they concentrate on, chromosomes 18 and 19. And they find, so this is where chromosome 19 is, which is very central as far as the nucleus is concerned. And this is chromosome 18, which is far more peripheral. Okay, so that's the abstract of the paper. And look at the chromosomes 18 and 19 and what they're made of. They have roughly the same size. One is 60 MB in size, the other is about 78 MB in size. But their gene densities, so chromosome 19 had 62 genes per MB, and chromosome 18 has about 18. So they're very different in gene density. They have comparable sizes. So then the idea is maybe these are distributed according to their gene density. And maybe that is the underlying positioning rule for chromosomes. Okay? So the way you would do it is the following. As I said, now you find out where, take a sphere, look at distance r, look at everything in a shell about that distance r, ask what are the chromosomes that are represented in that, and construct this quantity, s of r, which is 4 pi r squared, p of r, where p of r is the probability of finding a chromosome at a certain radial distance, r. And because it's a function only of radial distance, it's p of mod r. If this is uniform, p of r is a constant, and s of r is just quadratic, it's 4 pi r squared. So this is one way of representing where a chromosome, the probability of finding a chromosome at a given radial distance r. So if you distribute them uniformly, s of r is just quadratic, it's maximum in the nuclear envelope. And this is a good diagnostic, in a sense, given the data, for the non-trivial positioning of chromosomes. So here's the real data. So this is from a bunch of papers from the Kremer group, and this is two sets of chromosomes. So this is, I think, 18 and 19 here. This is chromosomes 12 and 20. And there's a reason why these are chosen. 12 and 20 are different in size, but are comparable in gene density. Okay? 18 and 19 are about the same in size, but very different in gene density. So if these chromosomes are ordered according to gene density, you would predict that chromosomes 12 and 20 should have roughly the same distribution, whereas chromosomes 18 and 19 should have very different distributions in terms of this function that I showed you, the S of R function. So this just takes this data, normalizes it, puts it into a plot, and this is 18 and 19. You can see that they sort of basically behave more or less the same. Sorry, not 8, this is 12 and 20. This is 18 and 19. So this is chromosome 19 over here, the blue one, and this is chromosome 18 here, the red one.
So when you say gene density,
so there's a sort of debate about the, there are papers that say that this depends only upon total gene density and not on active gene density. Yeah. Okay, so this is the logic behind this particular combination, 12 and 20, and 18 and 19, and we'll come back to these in a bit. But it's clear now what the data says. The data says that, look, this looks very different from this, and the difference between this and this is that this has more genes per unit length than this has. And this is something that we'd like to try and understand. So that's the next question. Given that we now know that chromosomes are, in many but not all cases, radially ordered by gene density, how do we understand this particular rule? And what does it mean? So this is where, so that's all of what's happened so far has been in the experiments, experimental introduction, what is the problem, etc. So now I'm going on to describe the theoretical ideas that go into modeling this particular situation. We start with a hypothesis, and the hypothesis is that it's a non-equilibrium mechanical activity, which comes from essentially transcription and the lot of remodeling of chromatin that happens in the vicinity of active gene that is responsible. This is inhomogeneous across the gene-rich and gene-poor region, and this is what gives you gene density-based radial segregation. That's the hypothesis, and we have to figure out ways of testing this hypothesis and comparing these tests to data. So, yeah.
Can I ask a naive question? If I put this hypothesis at face value, it seems to me like the gene-rich guy should be outside, not inside.
Okay. So let's make a hypothesis. Let's decide how to test the hypothesis and confront that with, and confront the test of the hypothesis with the experiment. Okay. And I will talk about ways to understand this, if at all, later. So let me tell you that this is very different from other canonical models for active matter. There is no self-propulsion in this particular approach, unlike in virtually all active matter models I know of. But there is inhomogeneous activity. It's different from point to point, even along one single chromosome. Its confinement is very important, not letting these guys go. There are no periodic boundary conditions. You're enclosing them in a spherical or ellipsoidal volume. And the character, the polymer characters also turns out to be very important. So these are three features, some of which are present in some models, not all of which are present in, you know, in any single model so far. So the last statement is that chromosome territories are a natural consequence of compact chromosome configuration and this type of activity. So the hypothesis is that we can understand these two very different problems. Why are chromosomes segregated according to gene density, and why do they form a territorial structure with the same bunch of ideas? Okay, so let me come to the first part of this, which is about the non-equilibrium mechanical activity and where it comes from. So to do this, what you really have to understand is that this picture of just DNA with these sort of nucleosome particles distributed uniformly is actually not what happens at all. There's a lot of remodeling that happens whenever you have to transfer particular genes. The reason you have nucleosomes at all or histones at all is really charge compensation. DNA is negatively charged. And in order to package 2 meter DNA per chromosome and multiplied by 22 chromosomes, 23 chromosomes multiplied by 2 because these are doubled, is an extremely complicated packing problem. The only way you can do it is to essentially charge neutralize the negatively charged DNA by complexing it with positively charged histones. But once you do that, you have this extremely compact structure which you must now be able to physically relax in some way. So what does that is this active machinery that moves in regions where you want to transcribe, you want to clear out nucleosomes, you want to open that up, and that's what all of this machinery does. And there's now there are many, many of these molecules, large numbers of these molecules inside the nucleus. There are groups of ATPases, there are various names that biologists, the switch SNF, ISW1, et cetera, that biologists have for this. So these do many things. They remove particles, they slide particles back and forth, and all of this is ATP consuming. So they work together through interactions that are specific to the renormaler. They're highly dynamic, they come on, they come off, they're present at large density. Of course, the other source of activity is just the regular transcription. First of all, transcription is something that you have to copy the DNA into RNA. This introduces changes, sort of defects within the DNA cell, which have to be repaired by DNA repairing machinery. So there is a lot of activity going on whenever you have regions of transcription that is completely non-equilibrium. You can estimate the barriers to this nucleosome motion from one step to another. It's about 20 to 40 kBT. So this is a good, I mean, the hydrolysis of a single ATP molecule gives you somewhere between 20 and 25 kBT. So this number is a good reference number to keep in mind for the scale of active forces in comparison to thermodynamic forces. So what is it, what are the mechanical effects of this? So we make a hypothesis here, and we say that once you coarse grain over sufficiently large regions, you break up the whole DNA into sort of 1 MB blobs, 1 megabase blobs, you average over the time scale required for a proper coarse grain description. What you have essentially is a local active temperature associated with regions where there's a lot of this activity going on, and a much lower temperature associated with regions where there is less transcription, fewer genes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The argument is a physical one, that more transcription implies more ATP consuming activity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this should at some level be accurate. The second thing is the coarse graining to the right scale that you want. And of course, you don't want to describe everything at the scale of a single base pair. So it's believed in the community that works on chromatin that the 1 MB scale is a reasonable coarse graining if you want to talk about territories and why they form. So we will use that number of 1 MB, and we will block things into these 1 MB units along the chromosome. And then you can estimate, as I said earlier, what the scale of this active temperature is from what we know about the barriers to moving nucleosomes, changing them, etc. Okay, so this is the picture. Here's one particular chromosome. Here's one part of it that might be an inactive part with fewer genes. This is, you know, stuff is attached to it, but there's not much activity going on. And here is a hot part, an active part, where there's a lot of remodeling, machinery, etc., all of which is ATP consuming. So there's hot parts and cold parts that coexist in this description. So here is chromosome 18 and 19 in the background of other chromosomes in the simulation model. Here is what the surface of the structure looks like. And I will describe to you where these come from and what the model does. Okay? So the model for chromatin is a standard model that is used by in a combination of theory and experiments. It's called the spherical chromatin domain model, which basically bunches these up into 1 MB domain, puts little linkers between these domains. The dynamics that we'll use is standard Oberdamp dynamics. The only twist is that this noise here, the Brownian dynamics, the Brownian noise here depends upon which monomer you're at. If you have a monomer, as I said, which we label as active, you will call that active monomer hot monomer and assign it a higher temperature. Then you will another monomer where the G density is low and it's inactive. Okay.
Are the springs connecting the different
There are springs, so I'll come to that. Yes, there are springs, there are interactions, etc., which I will just describe. Okay. And this is a complicated calculation. You can do many things. You can change the shape of the nucleus. You can introduce specific interactions between the chromatin and the nuclear envelope, etc. You can make this, the confinement itself, you can make active. But now let's just get into the more biological calculation. And how do we assign, depending upon gene density, a activity to each of these monomers? So there are about 6,000 odd monomers in the 6,098 to be precise. So here is where you have to do a little bit of very simple bioinformatics. You know per chromosome in the human genome what the gene density is. So you take data for what these blocks are like in 1 MB block. And this is the plot here. This over here is gene density on the y-axis. And this is location along chromosome 1, chromosome 2, chromosome 3, chromosome 4. What we do is we put a cutoff here and say that anything, any region in which falls above this cutoff, we will label as active. Any region that falls below this cutoff, we will label as inactive. We can modify this. This is just one particular assumption that is made for simplicity. And you can do this for all of the 23 chromosomes, 22 plus X chromosomes, and thereby map from here this division between active and inactive chromosomes.
So is the threshold the same for all the chromosomes?
The threshold is the same for all the chromosomes, yes. Okay.
So where you showed there is no difference.
The scale is different. The threshold is the same. So you can look at the number of genes per unit, per 1 MB unit, and then this cutoff would fall roughly here. So basically, all of this stuff here is active, and this is, there are some that are very rich here, some point here, and all of this stuff here is inactive. And you can be more clever about how you want to assign it, but there is not that much of information for a model at this level that you can fold into this calculation. Here are sort of specific numbers for how big you choose the domain size, the nanometers in size. There are various polymer calculations that go into describing this. The only point that I want you to note is that these polymers are self-repelling, but they're not self-avoiding. That is to say, they can cross each other, but they do pay a certain penalty in energy for doing so. Okay, we can come back to this particular point later. As I said, you can tune the interaction between monomer and wall. In most cases, we just assume it to be the wall to be completely repulsive at contact. In some cases, you can make it attractive to a certain type of monomer because you want to simulate something that is specifically biological in nature. So here are simulation configurations. As I said, you can do spherical confinement in equilibrium. You can do ellipsoidal confinement in equilibrium. You can do non-equilibrium with spherical confinement. So you can just do any particular combination that you want to, in order to test any hypothesis that you might have as to what might drive segregation and structure. Okay, so here is sort of one set of results. Take all of these 23 pairs of chromosomes, put all of them at the same temperature, and then ask what is the nature of positioning between chromosomes 18 and 19 and 12 and 20. These are our model chromosomes. We know which they are because we're specifically doing a biological or biophysical problem. So we have, our system is finite size. There's no thermodynamic limit. We are very constrained in what we can do with this. And over here, this is a representation of the local temperature in the sphere. So the scale is, so 0 is equilibrium temperature. 1 is 20 times equilibrium temperature, which is the upper scale of what we call active. So no surprises here. In thermal equilibrium, the distribution is more or less uniform. There is no segregation. Of course, everything is at the same temperature, so there can be no segregation, no hotter parts. And you can see that these two distribution functions are more or less the same. This slight difference is probably because these are not the same length. So there is some size effect, but as you'll agree that it's not very it's not very strong. Now you can just heat everything up and keep these, all of them, at a temperature that is 20 times the thermodynamic temperature. So then that's this top of the scale. You can see that again, it's very uniform.
What is the background noise? We were going to look at 18, 19, and so forth in the background with everybody else.
Exactly. So everybody is at the same temperature.
So the background is the bath.
No, we're looking at all chromosomes. We're simulating every chromosome, every monomer. It's just that every monomer sees the same temperature in this. So this is just standard Brownian dynamics of a polydispersed polymer system, where the temperature is chosen to be the thermodynamic temperature in the system of units that we're using.
Wait,
yeah?
The uniform distribution would correspond to parabolic
increase. Yeah.
This is more or less what you see
here, depending upon the model that you use for the wall. There is some structuring at the wall. which is why you see this little turn over here. And over here, because the chromosomes 12 and 20 are not the same size, there is some marginal size effect that you see here. I mean, it's not very significant, but basically you can see that on average they're following the same quadratic trend, and they come down at the end. So you can, you know, do this at 20 times room temperature, and that's again what you get. You see no structuring here at all, and there's not much change in this difference. It again looks more or less kind of quadratic. I don't want to make too fine a point to that. The interesting thing comes when you do what I suggested, which is take 95% of them, keep them at the thermodynamic temperature, and 5% are these active monomers, which you keep at 20 times thermodynamic temperature. So now you can see that chromosomes 18 and 19 segregate out. The distribution function for chromosome 19, which is the more active one, now peaks towards the center and comes down towards the outside, whereas chromosome number 18 goes up here. Okay? So this is experimental data, this point here, and the lines are the theoretical fit, and I think the same thing happens here. Chromosome 12 and 20, you don't predict a large change, and that's more or less consistent with what you see. Okay? Over here is the most interesting picture. If you ask, where are the high temperatures? Are they distributed kind of uniformly? Are they preferentially towards the outside or the inside? What you see is the more active stuff tends to be towards the inside, the less active stuff towards the outside. So that's the sort of segregation that is seen in the experiments where euchromatin, which is gene dense, early replicating, is typically found towards the center of the nucleus, and heterochromatin, which is, you know, the highly packaged form of chromatin with relatively fewer genes, is found towards the outside. Sorry. The variance of the noise is different, but in thermal equilibrium you would couple that variance to the dissipative term, to the viscosity. Here this is out of equilibrium, so you violate fluctuation dissipation at that point. Once you do this, the problem is just a problem of these two different bath sets, different sets of monomers that are connected to, and that's when you have this type of behavior. No, you don't. You just prescribe a temperature in terms of the noise that each monomer sees. That's 5% of the monomers see a higher noise, 95% of them see the lower noise, and yet automatically you get the sort of segregation with the more active, the higher temperature monomers being towards the center, and the less active ones to the outside. And this is the specific comparison to 18, 19, 20, 12, and 20.
And so in the previous noise, you had assigned the same temperature to all.
Exactly,
them.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a bit of a, you know, it's just to make a point that is more visual, that in this case you don't see any sort of change in temperature. Here you don't see anything. But this interpolates between these two, with the less active outside, more active inside.
And you took the chromosome 18, 19 altogether?
You start with a completely random initial condition. And you check over multiple initial conditions. These are steady states, so they don't depend upon how you prepare it.
Basically chromosome 1, 2, 20, everything there.
These are the ones that you pick out. This particular curve shows is for all chromosomes. So this just indicates the segregation between active and less active. And this is just the same set of graphs again all together, so you can look at it.
You think you would get the same thing if you would actually get rid of the polymer connections, just having monomers?
You don't. So this is interesting. So as I said, this is a understand, I'll come back to this particular point later, but the answer to that question is just disconnect the connections and you don't get segregation.
A question.
Yeah.
I'm a little confused. So this distribution, the probability distribution for the position of the whole chromosome 18 and 19.
Yes.
You measure the center of mass?
So you don't do it by center of mass. You look at where, it's an extended molecule.
Yes.
You count the monomers in each little shell. So if you have one monomer at a shell that is close to the center, you count that. If another end of the polymer is towards the outside, you count that. So you don't do center of mass. You essentially look at the distribution of DNA along that whole polymer. And that's what the experiments do. That's what we compare to.
That's the distribution of the monomers on that.
Yeah.
Exactly. Polymer. Exactly. Of the DNA associated with that particular chromosome.
How long is
their
polymer?
There are totally 6,098 monomers. There are 22 plus X. This is a XX system. It's a female chromosome that we're trying to, a female nucleus that we're trying to model. So there are 46 chromosomes divided with these 6,098 monomers divided among these 46 chromosomes. So as I said, we can do things like simulate funny shapes of nuclei. And the reason we did this is there was an idea in the literature, in the chromatin literature, that maybe the shape of the nucleus has something to do with this distribution. We find that it has nothing to do with the distribution, at least at this level of aspect ratio. These are not, these aspect ratios are 3 and 1 by 3, so it's not very distorted. But at least qualitatively, they don't seem to be very different.
All the things in the nucleus.
Yes, yes, I will get to some of them. I mean, not so. I mean, so we don't deal with the nucleolus. We don't deal with anything else. So this is just a sort of large, coarse-grained model for this.
Why you didn't see in the statistics in the parabola there's actually a spherical object inside the nucleus where there's no chromatin.
I agree. So there's so my guess is that maybe it's because it's averaged over many nuclei. So the position of the nucleus can vary between each of these. So it probably suppresses each of these in a sort of... So I don't know. I mean, so this is something that I don't know about how they treated the data, how they got rid of it. But so you're certainly right. There's lots of stuff inside the nucleus that presumably does have some amount of effect. This data is just the data for what the chromosomes are doing, 18 and 19. So presumably it includes all of that.
So you're talking about the distribution as a function of radius out from the nucleus, right?
Yeah.
So a further question is the distribution as a function of, say, latitude and longitude, right? And how each chromosome gets some territory that way. And you might think that the ellipsoidal shape would be especially important for that, because then, you know, the latitude and longitude would be especially significant. Right?
I'll talk a little bit about that. So these relate to sort of evolving ideas about the fact that maybe radial gene density dependent segregation is not everything. There are important interactions between chromosomes that might favor particular chromosomes to be in a particular spatial relationship with respect to each other. If they had, for example, the same activity, you might have predicted they would be, their probability distributions would be uniform. Mm-hmm. And it didn't matter whether something was here and something was here or whether they were close together, as long as they were in the same shell. But these interactions do seem to be important in some situations, so then that question is very valid. The model doesn't have that. As far as the model is concerned, everything is purely radial. But we could potentially do that as well.
I think if I remember right, one of the experimental data was chromosome 18 or so. That was on two sides of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they show up in the same place in the distribution anyway, but you haven't seen one chromosome split up into two parts in your simulation, have you?
So there are, these are pairs of chromosomes. So this in the interface cell, there are pairs. So there are sets of two, always. Of the same chromosome. So this is averaged over both those sets. Okay, so nice picture, very pretty, et cetera, et cetera. But there you don't see any chromosome territories. This is what you get. What you would like is something that looks much more like this. So then what happened? Why is it that the second important part of large-scale nuclear structuring didn't come out? The reason really is that our model for individual chromosomes assumes that these are unstructured objects, they're just polymers. That turns out not to be true. And a bunch of work, especially in the last 3 to 5 years, which says that this is the sort of this mean square displacement between two points, the radius of gyration between two points, is a function of the genomic distance between them, distance calculated along the chain. And it sort of goes up as, you know, pretty much any polymer model would do, but then it saturates. And the saturation is compactness. If it is not compact, if it's just a random walk, it would go up as n to the power 1/2. At large, and R squared would go as n at large scale, instead of which it doesn't do that. There are many types of models of individual chromosomes try to address data like this. Is the Rosette model, Hilcrow fold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We work with one particularly simple one called the random loop model. The one that has a lot of press is called the fractal globule model. And essentially, we believe the answers should be related or the same in both of these cases, but this is just much more complicated to do, so we don't do it. This is only in vivo. Yeah, I don't know what the in vitro data. So essentially, these models try to model experimental information about contact probabilities. Because our model functions at the 1 MB scale and larger, so that we're really talking about data that is, there's not that much of data here. This is genomic distance in 1 MB. So out of this data, we just take one essential fact. That is, this should level out. That leveling indicates that your chromosome configurations are compact at the individual level, and it doesn't matter too much how you do that. You can do that dictated by your experience of polymer models, but you can see there's a fair variety of these, not too much to choose between them given the quality of the data. And these, at any rate, address scales that are much smaller than the scale that we are interested in. So we, as I said, we implement one of these models, one of these modern models called the random loop model. And this just says that pick any two points on the chromosome with equal probability and connect them, irrespective of how far apart they are in sequence space. So this, as you can see, will give you an initial rise at short distances and then the saturation. And we choose a number of loops to be consistent with what people have used in models for individual chromosomes earlier. And now we can see this very nice separation into territories. And so this, we are looking at the surface of the of each individual.
Connect them meaning put springs?
You put a strong spring between them. It's a sort of strong, so that they're essentially constrained to not move apart.
Even the ones that might be used, like fire chromatin. The loop supreme are literally segregated.
Looped, polymer loops disaggregate. Yeah. They tend to phase separate.
So if you have loops in the polymer, these loops will be separated.
People don't know that, and people don't know how to actually implement that particular argument. There are, it's a complicated polymer argument, sort of arguments that lead to this, as I said, the fractal globule model. It says that self-avoidance is very important, topological constraints are very important. It corresponds to taking a good polymer from a good solvent, quenching it immediately to a bad solvent, in which case you have fractal-like structures that all scales. These relax very slowly, so they're out of equilibrium. The structures at the surface of this may form loops. It's these loops may effectively repel. And you know, you can construct a whole bunch of epicycles of arguments like this. But at some point, this may be a simpler way of thinking about it. The other thing is sort of a general point is, if you come from a soft matter polymer physics background, it's true that the constraint of no crossing is an absolute constraint. So polymers are self-avoiding physically, they cannot cross. However, the cell has lots of machinery that is specifically tailored to solve topological constraints. Right? And these type 2 topoisomerases specifically do that. So you can say that my feeling would be that we know relatively little about the operation of these in actually disentangling polymer configurations, but theories that put all of their emphasis essentially on saying that these are perfectly self-avoiding polymers may not be completely correct from that point of view. That's the point of view I would take, but that's, you're free to decide what you want to do. Okay, so then the idea is, yeah.
Just to make sure I understand your model, when you take your polymer and you loop it, monomers
with
the spring?
So you pick two monomers at random, irrespective of wherever they are, you bring them together with some very small probability, and you connect them. And you can do this to have, 500, 200, 200, 5,000 loops, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You choose the number of loops to be consistent with what is known from experimental data for the distribution of those loops. And that's all. And the philosophy is that you don't really care what is the microscopic mechanism that gives you compactness. What you care is that you should have compact chromosome configurations. Compactness and non-equilibrium automatically give you a method for segregation. And those segregation patterns look like the sort of patterns that you would see in terms of chromosome territories. These are all distinguished, they move out, they don't want to come close to each other, they're separated already by activity. So just making them compact prevents them from messing up with each other. So then, so now we have to sort of do this again, put in compactness, put in inhomogeneous activity, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can ask, how does the model compare to data? So here is sort of, again, data. So this is data plus model. Data was here, model was in line. And you can see that it actually does pretty well. So it's described the real simplicity of this model. It does things more or less correctly. And I showed you 12 and 20 and 18 and 19 because there is lots of data and this is comparable. There are things to compare this calculation with. But you can see that you can compute distribution function for all the chromosomes. Like at some point someone to look at what this looks like with respect to data. And of course, a big prediction is certainly this, the fact that you see segregation by activity. So, did we solve this problem, et cetera? Do we understand everything about it? The answer is certainly not. And there are many papers, this is a large literature. So many people have said different things about different systems, different cell types, et cetera, et cetera. So one idea is that positioning may correlate in some cell types to nuclear shape and to chromosome size as a consequence. And certainly in our simulation, we found no effect on nuclear shape. But on the other hand, you can sort of argue that the sphere has maximum volume for minimum surface area. So any mechanism that relies on surface effects is enhanced in more flattened cells, in more ellipsoidal cells. So that might be one reason why, it's just that the surface tends to be more important in these cases. So this is a movie shot in Santa Barbara, Meryl Streep. the name of the movie is It's Complicated, which pretty much is the description of what of all of this complexity here. What the nuclear envelope and the laminins tied to it does to nuclear architecture is an ongoing issue. And there's lots of data that suggests that the laminins are doing interesting things. They may not just be associated with the nuclear envelope that can penetrate downward and do interesting things there. This is, again, a question mark. And this question that you asked, Jonathan, about the relative positioning being an issue, that's, there's a lot of work now that says that highly transcribed regions on different, on the same or different chromosomes tend to loop into common points, which are called transcription factories. And this looping provides you a way of concentrating transcription machinery in particular regions, and therefore not spreading it out too much. It's just maybe a more efficient way of doing it. So that's, again, as you can see, we're very far from addressing any of these problems, but we do have a sort of basal understanding of something. So the way we would like to look at it is that there is a hierarchy of positioning drivers. There's sort of more complexity as you go up. So what we think we may understand in terms of this model is just the lowest level, the activity-based radial segregation. But everything here is more complicated, and these are incremental descriptions that you have to add to the model that we have. What is nuclear shape, envelope, laminins doing? What's the role of these transcription factories, the interchromatin domains? What about higher order interactions where multiple loops come and form at the same transcription factory? What is nuclear actin and myosin? This is, there is actin and myosin inside the nucleus for all the efficient orders of nuclear of actin and myosin. What all of this does is still largely unclear. I mean, it's clear to, in a sort of biological sense, but how these combine into influencing a physical interaction between chromosomes at the sort of level that we're trying to model is not clear at all. So our, what a bottom line would be that this activity-based radial segregation might provide the template for all of these complex things that are happening at higher levels of description. So here's my conclusion. Chromatin is, I want to suggest that it may be a new and interesting model system for looking at active matter. This is what we started out with. So the suggestions of this work that we've done is two. First, that segregation by gene density and formation of chromosome territories have a common origin, and that's just inhomogeneous activity, that is out of equilibrium. And there are many things that are central to this calculation. Activity has to be inhomogeneous, confinement is important, and the polymeric nature of chromosomes is also important. So this paper came out exactly, almost exactly a week ago in Nucleic Acids Research, which chromatin biologists actually read, but no physicists would ever read. And this is uploaded on the website, so it can be look at it. And I'd suggest that these arguments are all given in great detail in that paper, so that might be a good place to read these things. So here's a quotation from a paper, sort of nice review article on the meaning of gene positioning. This says, the discovery of distinct radial positions of chromosomes and genes has changed the way we think about genome organization. It has highlighted the non-randomness of higher order genome organization, and it has inspired the pursuit of how spatial genome organization contributes to function. That's sort of a view of how important this particular problem is and why it's nice to study it. There are a whole bunch of different things that we are doing at the moment. So this is sort of limited list. So there is no such thing as the cell in which you sort of find out what the, where the genes are in sort of raw line and say. So what we would like to do is to try and relate this calculation to specific cell types. That involves a lot more biological and bioinformatic work than we are, as physicists, we would normally be comfortable with. So that's one thing we're trying to learn, teach ourselves, collaborate with other people to understand in a particular cell type what can we predict for positioning, while we change the interactions with the nuclear envelope, as we include these higher order effects from the interactions with separate chromosomes, can we attempt to reproduce actual data in terms of where the chromosomes are positioned, both absolutely with respect to the center of the nucleus as well as relatively with respect to each other. Nuclear envelope repositioning on DNA damage, stem cell chromatin, et cetera, where we have various ideas that I won't tell you about. And the other direction is purely statistical mechanical. What determines this? As I said, as I told Silke, this, if you cut these up into monomers, they don't segregate. So the polymer nature is important, but then we are still trying to find out what is these irreducible components that contribute to this. And the, as I said, the problem is hard because biophysically you're very constrained to thinking about one particular problem that is very well defined. You have a fixed number of monomers, you have a fixed amount of activity in a way of assigning them. So there is no thermodynamic limit, as I sort of point, as I pointed out earlier. So in what sense, so in these statistical mechanical calculations, we would like to be able to take a limit that is appropriate to a thermodynamic limit. How do you define polydispersity in that particular limit so that it has a relevance to what we want to calculate here? These are issues that we are struggling with at the moment and we hope to understand at some point. There's of course another reason for thinking about chromosome positioning. This is the condition called premature aging, Hutchison, Gilford, Fujairi syndrome. This is the laminopathy. And this basically comes because chromosomes, the attachment of chromosomes to the nuclear envelope is in some sense impaired. So even these sort of very broad, simplified models for chromosomes at large scales, how they attach, how they interact with the nuclear envelope, you know, have, in a sense, consequences for many of these conditions which can be thought of at least philosophically or broadly in the same manner. So there is, it's not just the sort of the scientific excitement of studying something in active matter, but also that these calculations may have relevance to specific diseases and conditions that hopefully physical theories can say something about. So thank you very much, and that's all I have.
So you model and find the chromosomes in the nucleus in all the different cell types arranged in the same way. Is that actually true?
So that's a slide that I probably don't have here now. So it's true over a large number of cell types. For example, it's true across different organisms. It's true across rats and pigs and mice and so on and so forth. There's a radial segregation by gene density. Yeah, but even then, even if you have a different number of chromosomes, the fact of their arrangement by gene density seems to be maintained across these organisms.
Right.
It's also maintained across the 8 to 10 million years of evolution that separates old world monkeys from human beings.
Right.
Okay. So in a sense...
So if you take an epithelial cell or an eye cell, and you look at the nucleus, then these probability density functions look the same.
In principle, yes. In principle, yes. People may not have studied these specifically, but among the bunch of cell types that I have studied in humans, this seems to be a general observation. It's known very clearly that heterochromatin tends to be outside and euchromatin tends to be inside. And that broad distinction certainly holds. The more complicated distribution functions for specific chromosomes may vary between cell type and cell type.
This idea about methylation, which is one of the genes switched on or switched off, which is the differentiation. The question was, does methylation change chromosome kind of arrangement? And the answer seems to be no.
If it changes activity, it should change positioning. So then the question is...
It is supposed to change. My cells are different.
Yeah. So that's something that we hope to address in the next level, where we look at specific cell types and then try and map. If you know what
it's
is for...
a contradiction, though, in the saying that certain cell types have completely different active cells, and yet the chromosome arrangement is it different, or isn't it?
Okay, so there's no real contradiction for a couple of reasons. First of all, this correlation between gene density and transcription levels, in which genes are actually written out, is broadly seems to hold across multiple cell types. The other thing is that we are averaging over a 1 MB region. So we tend to average out lots. Maybe one particular gene is not being transcribed, one is being transcribed. So that averaging operation, in a sense, smears out over multiple cell types.
Averaging
out so many genes. Now, we would like to do the calculation that is specific to cell type. We would like to look at epithelial cells versus liver cells versus something else, etc. And that's the next step of what we want to do.
There's a lot of cell types where one chromosome isn't actually expressed at all. Those cell types express all the chromosomes.
There may be. I mean, this is supposed to be a broad description.
Yeah, sure.
It may not hold for the specific cell type that you work on. And there may not be that many cell types that for which there is data. I think there are 4 or 5 different cell types that have been studied in the system, in the paper that I showed the data between the form. But it's certainly possible that other cell types may have surprises. But the broad distinction between more active chromatin towards the inside, less active chromatin towards the outside, that seems to hold, in the sense that heterochromatin generically seems to be found outside and euchromatin towards the inside.
It seems to be surprising as well. I mean, so if you've got this nucleolus who's making the ribosomes and they're making mRNA, are they near to the active genes right in the center of the nucleus?
I don't know the correlation. That's an interesting question. I don't know.
So I'm imagining so epithelial and fibroblasts, they are quite different cells from the point of view that they express very different genes. Like we cannot see cytokeratin in epithelial cells. So from that viewpoint, the genes specific to those proteins would be differentially located in these 2 cells. But another, but the question that I'm wondering is that some cells suddenly undergo huge change in mechanical microenvironment. They start to migrate through tiny pores and things like that. So in that, there is data showing that the nucleus undergoes huge deformation. So the time scale at which this segregation happens compared to the time scale at which these things migrate through small gaps. How do they compare? I mean, is it so like after you go through small gaps, your chromosomes, whatever.
So we have some estimates for time scales in the paper, the time scales for reorganization. So our estimates, but you should take that particular estimate with a huge pinch of salt, because it's very hard to estimate. Really, the hard things to estimate are the effects of the topological constraints. And if you actually have to sort of sort this out, and the question is, what level of pre-existing organization is there in the way these, when the cell was actually dividing before it launches upon interface? Our estimates were in the order of tens of minutes. So for reorganization to happen. The other very nice example of reorganization, which I think probably really points to an importance of activity, is if you damage DNA, either through radiation or through chemical treatment, there's instantly a repositioning. These chromosomes begin to move apart, some move outward, some move inward. As the repair proceeds, now DNA damage repair is highly ATP consuming. There's a lot of machinery that does that, it's up ATP. As it goes on, these begin to relax back to the initial configurations. This points completely to an active mechanism, because there's no way in which you would have this sort of steady state that is maintained that immediately is destroyed by something that specifically induces activity and then relaxes back into its initial configuration. That's another problem that we're very interested in looking at the moment.
So you showed simulations where you have 5% active chromosomes, and then you turn on self-interactions, and then you get clustering. But if you turn off...
Not self-interactions, everything interacts with everything, yeah.
All right, but then there were local loops that then led to the cluster.
So you put in the loops, and then you run it with the loops.
Sorry?
You put in the loops.
Yeah. And then finally you get the formation. But in the absence of activity, I would presume you would still get formation of domains, but homogeneous distribution.
In the absence of activity, you won't see domain. You'll still see things mixed up.
Okay.
Across multiple pictures. They separate very cleanly when you have activity.
Okay.
But they tend to intermingle if there is no activity.
Okay. And this sort of piggies off on Barna's question from earlier. I would have expected the active regions to migrate to the outside, not the inside. I don't know.
I want to take that statement back now. Because after looking at the model, it looks like, so if I'm very active, I want to have a spherical radius of gyration, so I want to stay in the middle rather than be confined to a shell where I cannot do this. So I take my statement back.
No, but I mean, Aparna may have taken her statement back, but this is not a trivial question. No, but this is not a trivial question. This is something we have been struggling to explain in a simple physical level.
Yeah, and how polymer moves to the center, right? To get a more degree of freedom.
Mm-hmm. So you could argue that there is more phase space towards the outside, because there's always more phase space to the outside. You could argue both ways.
It's just a simulation on the simulation.
Then you get no saturation at all.
It tends to
come down at the boundaries a little bit, but it's still quadratic. So the intercept at the boundary tends to come down, which is sort of, even if you think about hard sphere systems near boundaries, as you change their energy, which is they move, that tends to come down. But those arguments don't work, because if you cut it up into small little pieces, they don't segregate at all. So somehow polydispersity seems to be important. Homogeneous activity seems to be important.
Constraint is important, is what you're saying, right?
The constraint seems to be important.
Changed.
Yes, mm-hmm. But I'm not able to give you the simple physical explanation that I would have loved to have given.
Jimbo had a comment.
Yeah. So you just have like one chromosome, like 18, and so. If you run a simulation, does it have the same distribution as you run everything all together? I mean, it doesn't depend on interaction with other.
No, if you have a single chromosome, it could be anywhere. There's nothing that tells it to be in the middle. That could be anywhere, outside or inside. It's interaction between chromosomes that also contribute to this, but also the fact that activity is inhomogeneously distributed across these. For the single chromosome, nothing constrains its position. It could be absolutely anywhere, both outside or inside. So the single chromosome is like simulating a single particle. Instead, the distribution function does not depend upon qualitatively does not depend upon the temperature.
Okay, probably is a misunderstanding. I think each chromosome, so you are actually simulating the monomers, right?
Yeah.
Inside in a chromosome polymer.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So I would think that distribution is actually distribution of monomers. instead of this whole chromosome. Is that correct or not?
Well, it's not a distribution of center of mass, but you can just say here is the chromosome. The density of finding a part of that chromosome here or here or here or here or here, I will add all of that up and I will average it over many measurements. So it's a full distribution function of all of the density associated with that particular chromosome.
I'm still trying to come up with sort of a minimum model to see where this would come from. So one thing one might think about, I don't know, maybe simulating it in different geometries, like between two plates or something, or somewhat simplifying the geometry.
We're entirely periodic.
Yes, but then you're losing, it looks like it's on the boundary, seems to be important.
Okay, so my feeling is that the confinement is very important, certainly, because you have to have a radial distance. I feel that homogeneity is very important. But in some way, what is polydispersity doing, I don't know.
I mean, it's because of the Brazil nut effect, where if you shake it, it's size segregation,
yeah.
But the gravity happens as well, but boundaries can
sure.
have an effect.
But this is maybe Brazil nut dictated by activity and sort of modulated by boundary in a way that I don't understand. As I said, I'm very embarrassed that I'm not able to give you a simple physical argument for this. Hopefully I will be, maybe in several months from now, I should be able to.
So I'm just trying to understand the biology. Is the mRNA, does it have to go from the center where the most active and then diffuse rather than doing what you might think would be faster, just diffuse from there?
Yeah, it has to sort of diffuse from where it's made.
Right, okay. I mean, if you do the calculations, there's no particular barrier there.
No. It's known that the nuclear envelope is a repressive environment for genes. The stuff
sure,
that you want to activate, you want to move outward.
Yeah, sure. Just wondered if
it's not a general statement, but that's more or less true.
Just the density of the rest of the chromosomes aren't a significant barrier for the mobility of the mRNA.
I don't think so.
No.
Not that I know.
Maybe they could sneak into the spaces between the chromosome big X's or something. I mean, they're just little squiggles comparatively.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, have you checked the, before you introduce this group, because of the confinement effect, this monomer, the whole polymer cannot really move freely. Have you checked whether your polymer follows the Gaussian statistics or
So we looked at the statistics a little bit, and it turns out that the noise sort of messes things up. It's sort of hard to get really good statistics and pretty curves for what this is. So, as I remember, it shows Gaussian statistics until the point where it begins to level off because of the effect of the loops.
Mm-hmm.
That it certainly does, but that's a particular statement that I find it hard to make, because our data isn't clean enough for the individual chromosome level to say
and
meaningful
so
things about
it.
It can cross the space, so it's repulsive, but not self-avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, the argument for that is an argument about the biophysics of the situation, that it's possible that most polymer-based arguments may overestimate the importance of self-avoidance in a situation where you have lots of little molecules that in fact are specifically designed to help you get over such barriers.
I want to suggest that we close the discussion here and go prevent the conformity theorists from eating all our cookies. Thank Gautam one more time.